Chapter 11. Shabash. Knotted sheets, secret tunnels, and elaborate disguises were not the only way to get out of Colditz. As the war progressed, both sides showed an increased willingness to send their prisoners home via a neutral country. Following the capture of large numbers of German soldiers in North Africa, negotiations over prisoner exchanges started in earnest, and by 1943, some British soldiers, including medical orderlies, were being selected for repatriation. In August, Alex Ross, Douglas Bader's put-upon batman, was approached by one of the friendlier German officers. "Good news, Ross," he said. "You're going home." The Scottish orderly was overjoyed. "I was very excited at the prospect. It also meant I could get as far away as possible from Bader." He ran to find the famous flying ace in the courtyard and breathlessly relayed the news that he would soon be going back to Britain. "No, you're bloody not," said Bader. "Look here, Ross, you came here as my lackey, and you will stay with me as my lackey until we are both liberated. That's that." Then he stomped off, leaving Ross speechless. I couldn't believe that he was stopping me going home. He only ever thought of himself, and I was nothing to him, just someone to serve him. The other orderlies urged Ross to appeal to the senior British officer, but so ingrained was the habit of obedience, he simply accepted the injustice. Looking back, I should have complained, but I didn't. In those days, you just didn't go against what an officer said. Ross would spend another 2 years lugging the legless RAF officer up and down the stairs for his bath. A few weeks later, Frank Errol Flynn tried to commit suicide, having lost his mind. That, at least, was the impression he gave, both to the Germans and to fellow prisoners. Later, Flynn insisted that he had merely been pretending to have gone mad in the hope of being transferred to another prison, from which escape might be easier. But where Flynn's feigned madness ended and real insanity began was never quite clear, even to Flynn himself. By imitating psychosis, he may have sent himself in exactly that direction. In Colditz, as in society as a whole, mental illness was seen as weakness. It's possible that after 170 days in solitary, Flynn felt his grip on sanity slipping and tried to pretend he was play-acting. His behaviour had grown steadily more eccentric since his attempt to pick the lock of the parcels office in broad daylight. He spent long hours meditating, chanting in Sanskrit, and standing on his head. At that time, people didn't look upon yoga as being anything other than a bit round the bend. Stoolball, in which players beat one another to a pulp, was considered a much saner form of exercise. Sometimes Flynn was voluble, expounding the new religion he had invented, but mostly he was withdrawn and silent. If you're sitting at a table with people year in, year out, you can only say so many things of interest, he observed. They all get said. All you do is sit there. You know exactly what the man is going to say the next minute, exactly what he's going to do. It's very easy to get into a state where you don't care about very much. At times, Flynn exploded in violence. Lieutenant Flynn has been locked up, as he is again having mental fits and endangering the life of his comrades, wrote Unteroffizier Schädlich, who witnessed one particularly curious scene. He was sitting at a table with some others when he suddenly gets up, says, "Excuse me," goes to the next table where chess is being played, says, "Excuse me," again, grabs the chessboard and smashes it on the head of one of the players, so his head sticks through the frame. Without batting an eyelid, he then returns to his table and sits down, having again said a very polite, "Excuse me." One evening, Flynn was found hanging from a noose in the lavatory. "I had this rope around my neck and I put it over the cistern, put one foot on the floor and one on the lavatory seat, so if I wanted to ease the pressure on my throat, I could. I made sure I had a good red mark on my throat." Flynn was discovered and the alarm was raised. The goons charged up the stairs and saw the red mark and thought I'd tried to kill myself. He subsequently claimed that this episode had also been an act. His fellow inmates believed he had genuinely tried to kill himself, and so did Commandant Pravitt. A week later, Flynn described being transferred, not to another prison, but to a concentration camp. From his cell, he witnessed scenes of appalling cruelty. I saw barbed wire and starved-looking people walking about in striped uniforms, emaciated, reaching out, wanting help. They had a glare in their eyes like animals trapped and ready to be killed. Some of them were dying. I was thinking, what is this place? Who are these people? After a few weeks, he was back in Colditz. Over the coming months, Flynn's madness, real or contrived, or a combination of both, would grow ever more extreme. In the All-Indian Front Stalag 153 at Chartres, Biren Mazumdar was doing his best to drive the German authorities to distraction by constantly complaining about conditions in the camp and, whenever an opportunity arose, trying to get out of it. Almost every day I had rows with the German camp commander. He sawed through the bars on a window and scaled the 20-foot outer wall topped with broken glass before he was picked up by a floodlight beam and forced to give himself up. Emerged from 6 weeks in solitary, Mazumdar was awarded the peculiar distinction of a personal guard during daylight hours. He made my life unbearable and followed me everywhere I went, even to the WC. At night, he was locked up with a handful of other troublemakers in one half of a three-story block guarded by five Algerian guards with machine guns. Here, Mazumdar made his first real friend since his capture. SOA, or Trooper, Dario Singh of the 2nd Royal Lancers. A Jat Sikh from the Punjab, Singh was a giant of a soldier, well over 6 feet tall, with a flowing beard and hands the size of soup plates. The two men struck up an immediate bond. On the 3rd of June 1943, the two Indians broke out of Front Stalag 153. First, Singh gouged an opening through a 2-foot wall into the empty part of the building. The way he made a hole with only makeshift tools was really amazing, wrote Mazumdar. Then they forced their way out of a window that had been nailed shut and sealed with 2 thick sheets of tin. The camp gate was 500 yards away. Across a stretch of ground, punctuated by barbed wire fences and illuminated by searchlights. It was bright as day. They crawled to the first fence, 7 strands of thick barbed wire with loose wires between them. Singh noiselessly snipped the 2 bottom wires with a pair of cutters fashioned out of pieces of metal bedpost, and they wriggled underneath. 10 yards further on was another wire fence, and then another. Whenever the searchlights swept over, they flattened themselves into the earth, which turned to mud as the drizzle grew steadily heavier. Mazumdar felt a surge of hope. The rain would obscure the view of the sentries manning the machine gun posts at either end of the compound. On the other side of a track leading to the German garrison lay another 4 lines of wire. Singh cut the fences, methodically and silently, one after the other. Finally, they reached the iron gate, 18 feet high and surmounted by more rolls of barbed wire. When the searchlight had passed, Singh climbed to the top, snipped the wire, and hauled Mazumdar up after him. "Shabash, Dr. Saib," he whispered, the Indian word for bravo. They landed heavily on the other side and slid into the shadows. It had taken 3 hours to crawl from one side of the camp compound to the other. In the moonlight, Mazumdar caught the flash of his companion's wide grin. "Shabash," said Singh again, taking the doctor's hand and setting off at a jog. They ran for an hour without stopping. A stout Bengali doctor and an enormous Sikh cavalryman pounding through the rainy night. He was absolutely splendid, said Mazumdar. No words of mine can adequately express his daring, courage and perseverance. Singh hurled his homemade tools into a pond. As dawn broke, they hid in a clump of bushes, waited for nightfall, and agreed a plan. They would make for the Swiss border, avoid speaking to anyone for as long as possible, and walk only during the hours of darkness. We were clothed in battle dress and had only a few cigarettes and shoes. We possessed neither map nor compass. They headed south, skirting cities and towns, sleeping during the day in woods and under hedgerows. At last, famished, they steeled themselves to approach a secluded farmstead, where they were taken in, given food and clothing, and then sent on their way, with directions to another place of safety. Mazumdar was astonished and moved by the willingness of the local people to risk their lives by helping them. We were fed as we had never been during our captivity, and wherever we stayed, we received enough to eat. We always sought out isolated farmhouses, away from the main road, and we even avoided the secondary roads. Mazumdar spoke passable French and learned that 80% of the population hate the Germans and the Pétain regime. There is great discontent in the country. The average Frenchman is anxiously awaiting the invasion of France by the Allies. We were given every possible assistance by the French civilians. The peasants welcomed them, offered encouragement and sustenance, and tuned their radios to the BBC so the fugitives could listen to news from a world free of Nazi occupation. Not all the French were so hospitable. We were told to avoid rich people, and so it proved to be true. When two dark-skinned foreigners appeared at her chateau asking for help, the Comtesse d'Amplay threatened to inform the gendarmerie and slammed the door. The trek across France by Biren Mazumdar and Dario Singh is one of the great untold stories of the Second World War. Two unmistakably Indian soldiers trudged 900 kilometres in 6 weeks through Nazi-held territory. Mazumdar later listed the French regions they had crossed as if reciting one of his poems. Loiret, Nièvre, Cher, Saône-et-Loire, Jura, Aisne. They crossed three rivers, narrowly avoided capture by some civilians guarding a bridge over the Saône, and finally reached the foothills of the Jura, the mountain range between France and Switzerland. Their last host had warned that the border region was heavily policed by German guards. This was the most difficult part, wrote Mazumdar, who was close to collapse. Even Singh's granite constitution was beginning to crumble. In pouring rain, they slogged on, covering the last 100 kilometres in 3 days. Near the frontier at Dole, they knocked on the door of a farmhouse. It was opened by an elderly woman who ushered the famished men inside and sat them down to a meal of bread, cheese and wine. We had not eaten for 3 days and were feeling the strain. We must have appeared to her extremely worn and exhausted, and she begged us to stay for at least a day. The woman explained that the Swiss frontier was a few kilometres to the east and offered to find a trustworthy guide to take them to an unguarded border post in the mountains. Mazumdar hesitated, knowing the penalty for helping a prisoner of war, but she insisted. The next evening at sundown, a young boy from the village appeared and this very charming old lady waved them off into the deepening dusk. Mazumdar never discovered her name. At 9 p.m. on the 13th of July 1943, the pair crossed the border near the village of Malcombe. 3 hours later, at around midnight, they reached the Swiss village of La Ripe and staggered into the police station. After 3 years of captivity, the Indian doctor was finally free. His deliverance a tribute to tenacity, luck, and the kindness of strangers. Mazumdar's escape odyssey was over, but his trials were not. On the 3rd of September 1943, Michael Sinclair, wearing a false handlebar moustache and the fake uniform of a Wehrmacht sergeant major, hurled abuse in fluent German at a nervous sentry while brandishing a bogus internal security pass that was the wrong colour. In the rooms above, the clustered British officers could hear Sinclair's voice rising as he impersonated Stabsfeldwebel Gustav Rotenberger, working himself into a rage. The Franz Josef scheme was the most elaborate escape plan since the French metro tunnel. More than 50 officers had taken part in the preparations, producing escape equipment for a small army. 3 perfect uniforms and replica guns for the main participants, as well as 35 sets of false papers and civilian clothing for the escapers, who would climb down the walls and break out when Sinclair opened the gate. The window bars on the 6th floor of the former British quarters on the east side, now deserted, had been carefully severed over several months, the cuts in the metal concealed with black boot polish. For months, Sinclair had studied the mannerisms, bearing, and thick Saxon accent of Stabsfeldwebel Rotenberger, rehearsing his part under the direction of Teddy Barton, one of Colditz's theatrical producers. It took 15 attempts to replicate Rotenberger's ginger moustache before the result was sufficiently convincing to be approved by the escape committee. Cecho Kalupka bribed one of his soft goons into surrendering his numbered pass for an hour, which was swiftly copied and returned. The escape had been timed to take place when a particularly dumb-looking sentry was known to be on duty at the gate. After the evening roll call, the Stooges reported that Rotenberger was safely in the guardhouse. The locks to the old British quarters were picked, and the troop of escapers crept up to the 6th floor. A few minutes before midnight, Sinclair and his 2 guards climbed out of the sickbay window and onto the terrace. The escapers listened intently as their boots crunched on the gravel, and Sinclair barked commands. At the final gate, the first guard handed over the keys and marched off towards the guardhouse. But the second hesitated, unwilling to leave his post as instructed. The ivory-headed goon was not so thick as he seemed, or perhaps so stupid that he could not work out why Stabsfeldwebel Rotenberger was now angrily demanding that he should do something he had previously ordered him not to do. "He won't go," someone whispered in the darkness of the 6th floor. "Why the hell won't he go?" The sentry stared at the pass and back at the red-faced, mustachioed figure berating him. Then he lifted his rifle, pressed the alarm bell, and told the 3 men to raise their hands. What happened next is disputed. Sinclair was still loudly remonstrating when the duty officer, Gefreiter Big Bum Pilz, rounded the corner of the terrace at a sprint, summoned by the alarm from the guardhouse, with 2 more guards behind him. Everyone was shouting. Pilz drew his pistol, in what was later described by the senior British officer as a reckless and gleeful manner. In fact, amid the noise and confusion, he panicked. The British claimed afterwards that Sinclair had already raised his hands in surrender. The Germans insisted Sinclair was reaching for his own fake pistol. Pilz aimed his gun and fired. And from a distance of 3 feet, a single 9mm revolver bullet thudded into the chest of Michael Sinclair. He sank to his knees and then toppled sideways. "Good God," gasped one of the German guards, who was having trouble keeping up with events. "You've shot our Sergeant Major." It was at this moment that the real Rotenberger, panting heavily, came round the corner and entered a surreal scene, bathed in the artificial glare of the searchlights. 6 German guards, 2 with their hands up, a corporal with a smoking gun, and what appeared to be himself lying dead on the terrace. From the upper floor came howls of fury. "German murderers, you bloody murderers!" The fallout from the Franz Josef affair reverberated around Colditz for months. Pravit was almost beside himself, according to Eggers. The senior British officer demanded that Pilz be court-martialed for shooting an unarmed man. Pravit refused, claiming his guard had acted in self-defence, but an internal inquiry was launched and Big Bum Pilz was dispatched to the Eastern Front. Eggers was quietly pleased that, for once, one of our sentries did what he had been told to do. With typical schoolmasterly wisdom after the event, he claimed that the phony Franz Josef's moustache was the weak spot. He installed Sinclair's German uniform, blood-stained and bullet-holed, in his museum. Michael Sinclair survived. No one was more surprised by this than Sinclair himself. The bullet had glanced off a rib, passed through his lung, and exited below his left shoulder blade, missing his heart by 3 inches. After just a week of convalescence in the hospital at Bad Lausick, the Red Fox was back in Colditz, his arm in a sling, planning his next escape. The war beyond the castle walls was getting closer. The prisoners could hear it, on the radio and in the night sky, as Allied bombers pounded the major German cities in the escalating strategic bombing campaign. Operation Gomorrah in July saw 9,000 tons of bombs hurled at Hamburg, killing 37,000 people in the most ferocious aerial bombardment the world had ever seen. In October, it was the turn of Halle, just 50 miles away, the hometown of Reinhold Eggers. The electricity supply to Colditz was cut off for 24 hours. It was the closest evidence of bombing that we had ever had, wrote Eggers. On a single night in early December, British bombers killed 1,800 residents of Leipzig, just 30 miles to the north, and razed much of the ancient city. Padre Platt observed the steadily mounting glow in the distance. As the horizon blazed, the prisoners listened to the carnage with a mixture of elation, awe, and fear. The evening radio roundup brought news of the invasion of Sicily, the Allied landings in mainland Italy, and finally the capitulation of Italy itself and the flight of Mussolini. The prisoners began taking bets on where the second front against Germany would be launched from. The progress of the conflict could be measured in other, less obvious ways. In late August, some 2,000 Red Cross parcels arrived, the largest consignment yet, including 45 parcels of tobacco, coffee from Venezuela, and sugar from Argentina. The prisoners estimated they now had enough food to last for 5 months. But it was hard to avoid the conclusion that the Red Cross was encouraging prisoners to stock up on essentials in anticipation of a time when supplies might no longer get through. As the official protecting power, Switzerland sent regular delegations to inspect the camp and ensure that the Geneva Convention was being observed. These noted that while the prisoners were not starving, living conditions were steadily deteriorating, with inadequate electric light and hot water, no fresh vegetables, and shortages of toilet paper. The walls are so thick that in winter the rooms cannot be sufficiently warmed, noted a Swiss report in October 1943. Yet morale among the prisoners remained high. These are stubborn characters, embittered due to long imprisonment and humiliations, however, with unbroken spirit. They received the delegate with cordial hospitality. It is a pleasure to meet such men. The same Swiss official noted, however, that Flight Lieutenant Flynn is in a very bad mental state and recommended he be moved to another camp as a matter of urgency. His recommendation was ignored. The mood in the German garrison, by contrast, was growing darker. Some of the German soldiers had lost their homes or relatives in the bombing raids. Red Cross parcels began disappearing before they were delivered. Hungry guards were increasingly willing to risk trading with prisoners. Eggers noticed a lot of friction in the German officers' mess. Those urging tougher measures to keep the prisoners in line took their lead from the commandant. Whenever Pravit was informed of fresh acts of disobedience, his response was draconian. "Why don't you use your gun?" The chief of the German High Command, General Keitel himself, sent a personal letter of commendation to Pravit, along with official confirmation of his right to enforce discipline by any and every means. Pravit's deputy, a strutting little man known as the Turkey Cock, was also a man of violence in Egger's view, itching to show the prisoners who's boss here. The Germans still had the power of life and death over their captives, and as the possibility of defeat loomed closer, some were keen to exercise it. Hitherto, Colditz had been exclusively the preserve of the Wehrmacht. But the Nazi security services and the SS were becoming more involved in the camp and its occupants. An 18-strong squad of SS, under the command of the Dresden Criminal Commissioner, appeared one morning and carried out a mass search of the castle, but uncovered little. A new rapid response unit was installed at nearby Bad Lausick, amid fears that the British might deploy a snatch squad of commandos to try to seize the special prisoners from Colditz, including Giles Romilly and Douglas Bader. The British had no such plans, but this sinister deployment was evidence of growing Nazi paranoia. The Prominente would not be surrendered without a fight. By October 1943, the prison population numbered 205 British officers, 14 Australians, 15 Canadians, 33 fighting French, formerly a British auxiliary force, and two ghosts. When RAF pilot Jack Best and Navy Lieutenant Mike Harvey vanished back in April, the Germans thought they had escaped. In fact, they were hiding in a secret compartment under the chapel pulpit that had once been part of the Great French Tunnel. At night, they would emerge and be replaced by two other prisoners, while Harvey and Best slept in the vacated beds. The Germans sometimes conducted headcounts of sleeping prisoners. They both took the names of other officers, in case they happened to be intercepted by the guards, and circulated like normal prisoners until the next roll call. Harvey was D.E. Bartlett, and Best became Bob Barnes. After an escape, a ghost would take the place of an escaper to buy time, before disappearing back into the hole. This troglodyte existence took a toll. Best was a chain-smoking ex-farmer from colonial Kenya. A photograph from the time shows a man with the staring eyes of one who has spent too long underground, reading by the dim light of a candle made from cooking fat. In recognition of their sacrifice, the ghosts were bumped to the top of the escaping list. As autumn turned to winter, into the drab confines of Colditz fluttered a creature of dazzling colour and flamboyance. Mickey Byrne was a journalist, novelist and poet, a former Nazi sympathiser who had since embraced Marxism, a spoiled, louche, funny, good-looking, feckless man who had displayed astonishing bravery during one of the most daring commando raids of the war. He was also bisexual, openly and actively. The rest of Colditz never quite knew what to make of Mickey Byrne. Byrne's rich father was the royal family's solicitor. His mother's family had developed the French gambling resort of Le Touquet. Byrne grew up in a grace and favour house opposite Buckingham Palace, in a world of parties, smart weekends, fast cars and unmerited admiration. "I only had to lift a finger and it was all laid on." He went to Oxford, where he did no work whatever, and was sent down after a year, before breezing into a job on The Times, the establishment newspaper. He began a passionate affair with Guy Burgess, the Foreign Office official and communist later exposed as a KGB spy. When Byrne confided to his father that he was sexually attracted to men, he was sent to George V's doctor, who gave him Benzedrine injections. These made him hyperactive, but not heterosexual. A love of Wagner's music drew him to Germany in 1933, where he fell under the Nazi spell. My mix of ignorance, blindness, and semi-criminal benevolence, let loose in a world of intensely organized falsehood, turned me into a dupe, he later wrote. The fervent British fascist Unity Mitford introduced him to Hitler, who signed a copy of Mein Kampf for the smitten young Englishman. Byrne was thrilled by this gift and immediately lost it. He attended a Nuremberg rally and breathlessly described the great lights in the sky, moving music, the rhetoric, the presentation, timing, performance, soundtrack, exaltation and climax. It was almost aimed at the sexual parts of one's consciousness. He found himself sitting next to a Dutch aristocrat, Baroness Ella von Heemstra, with whom he started an affair. After the Nuremberg show, Byrne was given a tour of Dachau concentration camp with Mitford and her sister Diana, soon to be married to the British fascist leader Oswald Mosley. Byrne entirely, perhaps deliberately, failed to recognise the horror he was witnessing. I kept trying to convince myself it wasn't as bad as it seemed. But on returning to Britain, he spent a week as the paying guest of a Barnsley miner, and for the first time witnessed poverty at close quarters. The scales fell from his eyes with a resounding thump. What Hitler was offering me, as soul-saving, was shit. Byrne abandoned his right-wing views overnight and set off on a headlong charge to the left, embracing socialism and then communism as fervently as he had once supported Hitler's National Socialism. When war came, he joined the Special Service Brigade, a volunteer unit formed for commando operations, determined to compensate for his flirtation with fascism by joining the riskiest missions, armed only with a Jane Austen and a little ammunition. He trained in Scotland until he was unbearably fit, and then took a leading part in Operation Chariot, an amphibious attack on the dry dock at Saint-Nazaire on the Atlantic coast of France, where large German ships put in for repairs. On the 28th of March 1942, Captain Byrne led his unit of 28 commandos on a mission to destroy the port's machinery and gun emplacements, while the destroyer HMS Campbelltown, disguised as a German ship and laden with delayed action high explosives, rammed into the dock gates. Half of Byrne's troop were killed when their motor launch took a direct hit from a German shell. Byrne fought his way ashore, reached the objective alone, and was finally captured with bullet wounds in his arm and thigh and a shard of shrapnel in his back. "I had led no one, destroyed nothing, protected no one," he wrote, underplaying an episode for which he would be awarded the Military Cross. The Germans published a propaganda image of Byrne being led away under guard with his hands raised. The photographer had failed to notice that Byrne's left hand was surreptitiously raised in the V for Victory sign, an act of bravery and foolishness that was entirely characteristic. Aware of his earlier sympathy for their cause, the Nazis tried to recruit him as a stool pigeon. When that failed, he was bundled off to Colditz. "I am now living in a castle, as most of the best people do at this time of year," Byrne wrote to his parents. A few Colditz inmates suspected Byrne of being a German spy. Others mistrusted his loudly expressed left-wing views. But as a former pupil at Winchester Public School, he was soon knitted into the strange social fabric of the place. "When I arrived at Colditz, I was asked to join this very smart mess nicknamed the Bullingdon, made up of close relatives of the royal family and a few lords and lairds. None of them knew that I had been blackballed from the real Bullingdon when I was at Oxford. Back in 1930, he had been considered not the type for the exclusive club because he was bisexual." Mickey Byrne emerged as the radical philosopher-poet of the castle, a born optimist and one of the few men in Colditz who never got depressed. he wrote the only good novel to come out of the camp, entitled Yes, Farewell, a study of the psychology of prison life that captures the dreary decrepitude of the place, the smell of musty decay, and the pervasive atmosphere of tense inactivity. The novel's title bids adieu to the liberal certainties of the pre-war world. Byrne wrote poetry and sent it to his mother, who passed it on to various literary luminaries. J.B. Priestley thought Byrne's verses very promising, but T.S. Eliot considered his poetry immature and often awkward. His father was even blunter. "I hate poetry unless it rhymes." As for sex, Byrne later asserted that anything of that sort was a challenge, since it was very difficult to find sufficient privacy to make it enjoyable. The crowded conditions and a general censure made satisfaction almost hopeless. Almost, but not entirely. Byrne would emerge from Colditz convinced, wrongly as matters turned out, that he was exclusively homosexual. At the age of 30, Byrne feared he was losing his looks. "I now weigh no more than 10 stone. My cheeks have fallen in. My hair around the ears has gone the grey of a distinguished stockbroker and has deserted the temples entirely." With his reporter's shorthand and journalistic experience, Byrne was the natural scribe for the nightly news service. Every evening, while the jazz musician Jimmy Yule operated the radio, Byrne scribbled down the BBC highlights, edited them into readable form, and distributed the result around the various messes. Making up for earlier academic failure, he studied for an Oxford diploma in social sciences. He read the economist John Maynard Keynes, the Beveridge Report of 1942, which would form the cornerstone of Britain's welfare state, and works on employment theory. Byrne was determined to try to understand what the post-war world might be like. His views moved further leftwards, and he reached a conclusion. The ruling class, of which he was so fortunate a product, was damned and doomed. He learned Russian, and by the end of 1943 declared himself well on the way to Marxism. There were unhappy rumblings in the Bullingdon Club over the Red Revolutionary in their midst. But one of the Prominente found in Byrne an ideological soulmate. Giles Romilly had hitherto kept his communism, if not hidden, then certainly veiled. The two men now made common cause and began giving joint lectures on Marxist theory. These were well attended, particularly by the orderlies. Some of the more conservative inmates were deeply alarmed by what they saw as communist propaganda. One warned Byrne with mock joviality that, nice fellow though he was, he would end up hanging from a lamppost. Another demanded that he be tried for treason. Douglas Bader called Byrne a dangerous menace, banned his fellow RAF officers from attending Romilly's lectures, and gave his own rival talks on such themes as Stalin's war aim, the total military occupation of Germany, and opening a second front to ensure that Russia does not win the war alone. But the so-called Colditz commies continued to spread the gospel of Marx, exploring this unlikely foothold of free speech inside a Nazi prison. The ideological schism reflected and prefigured events in the wider world. A battle between the forces of communism and capitalist democracy, between defenders of the British Empire and those who saw it as a crime, between the class warriors and the traditional governing class. As winter fell on Colditz, a shiver of the looming Cold War could be felt inside it. Mickey Byrne had no desire to escape, and in this, too, he represented a different way of thinking. "I wasn't interested," he wrote. "I did what I could to help, but I felt someone should consider why we were there at all, why the war had started, why there should be any wars. It gave me a sort of escape within myself without having to get out." Unlike the earliest soldier prisoners in Colditz, enraged and emasculated to have been captured without much of a fight. Many of the newer arrivals had been blooded before their captivity and felt they had already done their bit. "I'd seen quite a lot of action," said Michael Alexander, the commando who had sabotaged a German ammunition dump wearing his tennis kit. "I didn't want to escape. They could get on without me quite well." Others quailed at the scale of the challenge. "It would have been too difficult for me to escape from Colditz," said John Wotton, an accomplished artist. "I did not consider myself competent to achieve the level of effort and skill required." Most would seize the opportunity to abscond if one arose, and almost all prisoners were willing to contribute to escape efforts, but a growing number were happy to leave the difficult and dangerous business of escaping to a hardened few. And so emerged a new and subtle distinction within the prisoner community, between those determined to escape and others for whom that prospect had receded to the point of near indifference. "Young men have grown old from weariness and hope deferred," Padre Platt wrote in his diary. "Conversation has almost stagnated, except for topics of war news, letters, and sex perversion." Every letter from home was avidly devoured. Mickey Byrne's former lover, Ella Van Heemstra, spotted him in the newsreel of his capture and sent a photo of herself to remind you of the good old days. She was now living under German occupation in Holland, her dalliance with Nazism, like his, a thing of the past. Her teenage daughter, Audrey, was training as a dancer, she told him. "We'll send you tickets for a box on her first night in London," she promised. The fourth Colditz Christmas came and went, and Reinhold Eggers totted up the escape scores, as he had every year since 1940. Just 26 escape attempts had been made in 1943, fewer than half the total of the previous year. Only one Frenchman had made it home, and he had done so after being transferred to a hospital outside the camp. Not a single prisoner had managed to escape from inside the castle. A Christmas truce was agreed between prisoners and jailers. There would be no escape attempts between Christmas and New Year, in return for a German promise to launch no midnight roll calls or searches. The intensity of the struggle between the jailers and the jailed was dissipating. Colditz would never be escape-proof as originally intended, but it was far more secure than it had been at the outset, as in the wider war, exhaustion was setting in, along with the faint hope of an ending. Before Christmas, Allied aircraft launched another massive bombardment of nearby Leipzig. The festive lights that year came in the form of high explosive that engulfed the city in fire and lit up the night sky. Gone were the theatres, most of the university, more than 1,000 commercial buildings, 472 factories, 56 schools, 9 churches, and the Café Zimmermann, frequented by J.S. Bach, the backdrop for the first performance of his Coffee Cantata. While Nazi hardliners still insisted victory was just around the corner, Eggers knew the end was only a matter of time. Among most of his fellow officers, he detected a complete lack of confidence in our military and political leaders. Eggers was no defeatist. Like many patriotic Germans, he would battle to the end, whatever his private feelings about the Nazi leadership. Yet he had sensed what others were not prepared to put into words. A gradual, almost imperceptible shift in the balance of power within the camp. "How was it all going to end?" Eggers wrote. A catastrophe for Germany was inevitable.